Good morning. I'm Barbara Tobias. Today's Sunday, November 10th, 2019. This is the front section of the Cincinnati Inquirer. And our headlines today, Forgotten Soldier 10 Years After Fort Hood. Cincinnati man is fighting a war for better treatment of veterans following his son's struggle with PTSD and death. This article is by Keith Bieri-Golick. On November 5th, 2009, a U.S. Army major killed 13 people and injured more than 30 others at a military base in Texas. Many of the victims are remembered at a memorial there. This is the story of one man who survived the shooting but could not survive life afterward. He killed himself in 2013, and he's not been memorialized. From a military evaluation of Joshua A. Berry in 2011, the following. Present condition and current functioning, colon. After the Fort Hood shooting, SGT, Sergeant Berry, developed severe PTSD symptoms, including a recurrent nightmare in which he's a passenger in a Chinook helicopter under fire in Afghanistan, when another passenger in the aircraft suddenly turns his gun on the service member and starts firing. He's also reported short-term memory problems and a reduced capacity to attend and concentrate. He started getting lost while driving in familiar places. Sergeant Berry was irritable, easily frustrated, and depressed. He had little appetite or energy and was unable to sleep. He was transferred to the Fort Knox WTU soon after the shooting. The soldier was unable to tolerate an inpatient PTSD program at a private hospital near the base, and he was allowed to go on remote WTU status in order to be treated at the Cincinnati VA Medical Center Partial Hospitalization Program, or PHP. While he derived much benefit from the group and individual psychotherapies offered at the PHP, trials of a number of different medications were ineffective in improving the soldier's anxiety symptoms or depression. This story has to start in a cemetery on a cold day with Howard Berry standing at a grave. It could be the grave of his son, who he buried in 2013, and visits at least once a week. Sometimes Howard wears his son's camouflage army jacket, and underneath, if it's cold, he's probably wearing a black sweatshirt mocking the Department of Veterans Affairs. Dysfunctional veterans, it says on the front. On the back, giving you another chance to die for your country since 1930. Howard is 63, and his wife tells him he spends too much time in cemeteries. When he's there, he might place a penny on his father's grave and a red "I am loved" button on his son's marker. He's probably tired or angry or both. If asked to explain, he'll say no one gives you a playbook for what to do when your son hangs himself at 36. Howard will tell you after his son's death he took Josh's medications to a drug drop box and had to come back another day because there were so many. But Howard might not be at his son's grave. Chances are, if you see him at the cemetery, he'll be at a stranger's headstone. And if there's a military designation, sometimes, even if there isn't, he'll bend down and place a metal rod in the ground. When he pulls it out, he'll place a small American flag into the grass. He'll do this over and over, often for hours and hours. Howard will likely be by himself over the objections of his wife, and this probably won't be his first cemetery of the day. At some point, he'll take a step back and smile. That looks pretty good. That's something he would say as his flags flutter in the wind. And if you drive by and ask what he's doing, he'll tell you. He might tell you his son was a veteran, failed by the VA and the country he fought for. He might tell you about his son's nightmares, or how his son's marriage fell apart because of post-traumatic stress disorder. He might tell you his son loves Skyline Chili and the Cincinnati Reds, but couldn't stand crowds after 12 years in the military. He might tell you about a picture of his son, arm in a sling, shaking hands with President Obama. He might tell you this picture was once the proudest moment of his son's life. And if he tells you about that, he'll tell you it eventually came to symbolize all the ways his son felt left behind. He might even tell you his son killed himself with the number to a suicide hotline in his pocket. Howard will tell you hundreds of veterans kill themselves each month. He'll tell you most people don't know that, and the flags he puts into the ground are his way of honoring the service members society would rather not discuss. What he probably won't tell you is you made his day by asking. from a psychiatric medical board evaluation of Josh in 2011, colon, the event that led to a dramatic improvement in Sergeant Barry's psychiatric status was the birth of his daughter during the summer of 2010. He was very happy to take on his new role as a father and proudly showed other veterans in the PHP program the pictures he had of his newborn daughter. Unfortunately, several weeks after she was born, the service member's wife sent him a text message stating that she was leaving him due to her discomfort with his ongoing symptoms of PTSD. Sergeant Barry then suffered a marked deterioration in his psychiatric status that ultimately led to his being hospitalized in October 2010 after his neighbors pulled guns on him when they found the SM walking around the neighborhood in full combat gear. He was discharged a week later on Tegretol, Haldol, Cogentin, Xanax, and as-needed Visperdal. Sergeant Barry continues to have nightmares every other night, but he can now fall back to sleep a few minutes after awakening. He's now getting about 7 hours of sleep a night, and the soldier's coping better with his daytime flashbacks and memories. After Memorial Day this spring, more than 7 years after his son's death, Howard drove to Columbus. He was scheduled to speak to an Ohio House of Representatives committee in support of a marker on Interstate 71 acknowledging veteran suicides. I went with him. In the car, we didn't listen to music or the radio. We just talked, or more precisely, Howard talked. I'd heard a lot of the stories before, like how he paid $25 for an American flag to drape over his son's casket, or like how Congressman Brad Wenstrup once kicked him out of a public event, and like how a prosecutor in the Fort Hood trial told Howard the Army was taking care of his son months after he killed himself. When we got to the State House, someone asked me how long I'd known Howard. I couldn't remember exactly when, but I remembered exactly where. I met Howard at Gate of Heaven Cemetery. I was working on a story about Cincinnati police officer Sonny Kim, who had been shot and killed in 2015. It had been a year since then, and I was almost done reporting on what Kim's loved ones had been through since his death. I'd never done this before, but I visited Kim's grave. I thought it would give me perspective as I tried to tell his story, and I spent a few minutes at the marker and then pulled out my notebook. I sat on a bench a few feet away. While I wrote, Howard approached Kim's grave, planted a flag in the ground, and walked back to his car. I thought he must be related to Kim. He never told me he never met him. He told me he never met him. And then he told me about his son, who was buried in the same cemetery. He told me he thought Josh had been forgotten and he didn't want the same thing to happen to Kim. 3 years later, Howard sat in the front row of a hearing room in Columbus. He stood for the Pledge of Allegiance, but didn't place his hand over his heart. He told me liberty and justice for all doesn't resonate with him anymore. In the car ride there, Howard told me no one understands what he's been through, what his son and many others have been through. He pointed out half a dozen signs on the side of the road recognizing politicians or athletes or soldiers killed in the line of duty. And he asked why veteran suicide is rarely acknowledged. That morning, he thought about dressing in a sarcastic VA T-shirt, but wore a shirt and tie instead. He wanted to honor his son, whom he told the committee had died of indifference. He also told them other stories about other sons, terrible stories, he became familiar with after his son's death. He told the committee about a man who overdosed when he left the military, a man who needed many drugs to serve, Howard said, but couldn't function without them when he got home. He also told them about a drone pilot, a man left broken, Howard said, and after he read a report revealing the deaths of women and children during one of his missions. Howard told the committee 22 veterans kill themselves every day. This is not about me, he said. This is about them. I miss my son, he said. On the way back to Cincinnati, we stopped at a military-themed restaurant that plays the national anthem every day at noon, a restaurant where photos of service members decorate the walls. There, Howard sat in a booth and ate a barbecue sandwich under a picture of his son. From an emergency room report in 2010. This is a 33-year-old gentleman. The police were called because he was outside of his house wearing full combat gear with a flak jacket on. He stated, if I had my sidearm, I would blow my brains out tonight. but indicates to me that he got rid of all the firearms in his house shortly after he came home from Fort Hood so that his wife would not have to put up with them. However, his wife then left him a little less than 3 months ago for her ex-husband, and he feels that he was let down by her, by the military. He does not understand why a major who's a physician did all the shootings in Fort Hood, and he was personally involved in this. He dislocated his shoulder when he was diving behind the desk to avoid getting shot. The reason he was wearing the flak jacket and full military uniform is because, in quotes, "I don't feel safe anywhere," end quotes. He went through a litmus of the situations he was in Afghanistan and Fort Hood issues and basically does not see much point in living. Several months after Columbus, I visited Howard's home. He says he hasn't heard anything else about the highway marker, and he's not surprised. When I walk in, he tosses a picture of himself standing next to Senator Mitch McConnell on the table. "He's nothing but an empty suit," he says. This is Howard's way of saying hello. A few minutes later, he reaches into the trash and pulls out an issue of TAPS magazine. TAPS, T-A-P-S, stands for Tragedy Assistance Program for Survivors. It's a nonprofit organization focused on helping grieving military families. Howard used to go to their meetings in Milford. He says out of roughly 20 families who attended, 16 were dealing with a veteran suicide. He stopped going because he didn't think the organization did enough to help vets before they killed themselves. Howard says his son once called a suicide hotline and was put on hold for 40 minutes. He says a military friend walked in and saw his son with a gun in one hand and his phone in the other. When Josh's mother found him dead in his Deerfield Township apartment, Howard says he had a suicide hotline keychain in his pocket. Another was found near his body. Like the framed picture of his son shaking hands with President Obama, which is on top of the refrigerator next to a loaf of bread, Howard still has the keychain. He keeps it inside a decorative wooden box given to him at his son's funeral. Also inside the box is an American flag, a scarf Josh wore in Afghanistan, and a newspaper article about Fort Hood. I ask him why he holds on to the keychain and other painful memories. "It's the truth," he says. Howard has spent years fighting for his son, hounding politicians here and in D.C., attending VA town meetings, pleading for news coverage, traveling the country, planting flags, and even suing the government. Now he says he understands why his son did what he did. From a medical evaluation of Josh in 2010. Social history, : he denies drinking or any drug use. General, : on exam, he's alert, appears very sad. He has poor eye contact with the examiner, stares at the floor and talks slowly, but does vary his voice and flexes appropriately to go along with what he's talking about. To explain this terrible feeling, Howard shows me letters he's written to Congress, more than 500 of them. He shows me, in quotes, "refused service," end quotes, envelopes that have come back and correspondence where his name is misspelled. He keeps them in a black binder with every letter placed inside a clear page protector. He's shown these to other reporters, too. For years, survivors of the Fort Hood shooting were denied Purple Heart benefits because the incident wasn't classified as a terrorist act. Such benefits include priority access to medical care and, in some cases, free medical care. In 2015, Congress changed the guidelines for America's oldest military decoration, and the Army granted Purple Hearts to 47 victims of the Fort Hood shooting. Josh was not one of those victims. He dislocated his shoulder in the incidents, but he wasn't shot. Howard is suing the Army for a posthumous Purple Heart. Last fall, the nonprofit group funding Howard's lawsuit sent out a press release. A federal judge had ordered the Army to further explain its reasoning for withholding a Purple Heart from Josh. The headline of the release read, "Judicial Watch Victory." It was a favorable decision, but Howard didn't really win, because there's no winning for him. Howard spoke to his son the day before the Fort Hood shooting. Josh had been deployed to Afghanistan for almost a year and was transferred to Texas because he was coming home. Howard says his son sounded like he won the lottery. He shows me a scrapbook of Josh's time in the military, flipping past photos of explosions, of Josh playing guitar, of Josh going back to school, and the birth of Josh's daughter. Howard cries when he gets to this page. He doesn't see his 9-year-old granddaughter anymore. Josh's divorce was finalized in September of 2012. He was found dead in his apartment 5 months later, a day after he didn't show up to court for a protection order hearing. He was wearing an ankle monitor. I ask Howard what Josh's death did to his family. "I don't have a family," he says. He hasn't spoken to his 2 daughters in months, and he says he's been told, "You care more about your dead kid than your alive kids." Howard's wife worries about his health, and his ex-wife told him no one ever changed anything by putting flags into the ground. In the scrapbook, there's a photo of the family at La Rosa's. This was in 2012, almost 3 years after Fort Hood. Josh is wearing a Wright State University sweatshirt. He had enrolled in college that year, or that spring rather, hoping to become a history teacher. On the first day, he took a picture with the school's mascot, a wolf. He dropped out as the shooting anniversary approached. In the La Rosa's picture, Howard looks happy. As he looks at the photograph now, his smile fades. He points to his son wearing an expressionless stare and says he wasn't there. Howard flips to the front of the book. He points to a different picture of his son, who was 18 when he first joined the Army, and says he sees a child, someone who didn't know what he wanted to be when he grew up. In other pictures, even when Josh is frowning, arms crossed in camouflage fatigues, Howard sees something. He sees his son. An incident report from the Warren County Sheriff's Office after Josh's death, 2013: Joshua has prescribed several medications through the VA hospital and has abused them in the past. I located a bottle of alprazolam, 1 milligram, filled on 2813, which contains 60 tablets, empty on the floor in the living room. 2 bottles of oxycodone, hydrochloride, 5 milligrams, filled 12-18-12, and 1-11-13, which contain 90 tablets, each empty in the bathroom sink. 5 bottles of carbamazepine, 200 milligrams, containing 60 tablets, each full on the kitchen counter. I also found a bottle of haloperidol, 5 milligrams, containing 30 tabs, full on the kitchen counter, a bottle of lithium carbonate, 450 milligrams, containing 60 tablets, full on the kitchen counter, and a bottle of mestropine mesylate, 1 milligram, containing 30 tablets, full on the kitchen counter. I collected the medication and entered it into evidence to be destroyed. Commanders in the Army said Josh always placed his unit and mission above himself. He was a gunner, a team leader, and once hurt his back running for cover from a rocket attack. Military records indicate Josh witnessed a number of horrible events in Afghanistan. In 2008, his supervisors in the military said Josh had unlimited potential. In 2011, Josh retired as a staff sergeant after officials found him unable to serve because of PTSD, his shoulder injury, depression, and arthritis in his spine. He could not lift more than 10 pounds. It'll be years before he can work again, officials said. Before he killed himself, Josh didn't pay bills because he refused to open the mail. He told his father there was never anything but bad news in it. In the end, the only thing Josh cared about was his child. Howard says if his son was awarded a Purple Heart, he would give it to his granddaughter. But this isn't a story about a Purple Heart or whether Josh deserves one. This is a story about a father and a son. This is about what a father does when he outlives his son. And so if this story starts at a cemetery, it must end somewhere happier. Maybe it's in Washington, D.C., where military officials present Howard with that Purple Heart. Maybe it's in Cincinnati, where a judge tells him his lawsuit led to real change. Maybe it's in Texas, where someone etches Joshua A. Berry into the Fort Hood Memorial, along with the names of other service members who have killed themselves since. The problem is these things might not happen. This story probably ends at Howard's home. He's trying to sleep, but the palms of his hands are bruised from pushing all those flags into the ground, and his back is howling in pain. His son is still dead, and Howard's wondering if he's making any difference at all. Congressional testimony from Howard Berry on September 17, 2013. The suicide rate is still rising among our veterans. I hope my speaking to you today was not a waste of our time. I hope it's the beginning of positive changes. After all, we're all responsible. The Fort Hood shooter was convicted of premeditated murder in 2013 and sentenced to death. He's in a Kansas prison awaiting execution, and the appeal process could take years to resolve. Four service members who were at Fort Hood that day and three of their family members have since killed themselves, according to Howard and Dr. Kathy Platone, a retired Army colonel and psychologist who saw friends die during the shooting. There will be more, Platone says. The suicide rate for active duty U.S. military members in 2018 was the highest it's ever been, according to recent Department of Defense study. Officials started tracking suicides in 2001. A true number of veteran suicides is virtually impossible to calculate because the VA only reports suicides of veterans in its care. Howard's lawsuit is ongoing. The Army so far has refused to give his son a Purple Heart. A federal judge is considering the case and has been for months. Howard recently spoke to a military father in Illinois. The man's son killed himself, too, and is now planning a flag display in his own city. If you're depressed or having suicidal thoughts, help is available. Crisis Text Line provides free 24/7 confidential support via text message to people in crisis when they dial 741-741. The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-8255. And continuing on in this front section of the Cincinnati Inquirer, the economy slows in Ohio, other political swing states. This is by Alexander Coolidge. The economy slowed in several political swing states during the second quarter of 2019, new data says. All 50 states in the District of Columbia saw their economies grow as measured by gross domestic product. That's the total value of goods produced and services. But data released Thursday from the Federal Bureau of Economic Analysis shows the growth is uneven. The top five fastest growing state economies were Texas, Wyoming, New Mexico, Alaska, and Washington. Four growing 4.1% or higher. Meanwhile, three states eked out growth below 1%, Hawaii, Maine, and New Jersey. Slowing growth in Colorado, Florida, Iowa, Missouri, New Hampshire, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Virginia might also spell trouble for Donald Trump, who's seeking to make, in quotes, the best economy ever, end quotes, a cornerstone of his reelection campaign. For the latest on Cincinnati business, P&G, Kroger, and Fifth Third Bank, you can follow at Alex Coolidge on Twitter. This is the front section of the Cincinnati Inquirer. It's November 10th, 2019. And next, poll. Most Ohioans favor requiring vaccinations with school children. This is by Terry DeMaio. An Ohio Issues poll released Wednesday shows that 82% of Ohioans think children should be required to be vaccinated to go to public school. And that matches national data from the Pew Research Center poll in 2016. The poll asked people which statement was closer to their view about childhood vaccines for measles, mumps, and rubella. Quotes, parents should be able to decide not to vaccinate their children, even if that may create health risks for other children and adults, end quotes, or healthy children should be required to be vaccinated in order to attend public schools because of the potential risk for others when children are not vaccinated, end quotes. Younger adults, 18 to 45, were more likely than those of older respondents to say parents should be able to decide whether to vaccinate their children. Well, also people living with children were more likely than households with only adults to say vaccines should not be required for kids to go to public schools. Interact for Health, which is a nonprofit health solutions agency for 20 counties in the Cincinnati region and beyond, commissioned the poll. In quotes, vaccines are one of the most notable public health advances of our lifetimes, end quote, said Dr. Odell Owens, president and CEO for Interact for Health, in a release. He pointed to research from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, showing that immunizations have saved millions from disease and death. The CDC estimates that 2.9% of Ohio kindergartners in the 2018-2019 school year had an exemption for one or more of the three major vaccines, measles, mumps, and rubella, diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis, and chickenpox. The rate is similar to the national exemption rate of 2.5%. Interact for Health released the poll in conjunction with a statewide Immunize Ohio conference on Wednesday in Wadsworth. That's outside of Cleveland. The Institute for Policy Research at the University of Cincinnati conducted the poll from June 19th through July 17th among a random sample of 844 adults throughout Ohio. The poll's margin of error is plus or minus 3.4 percentage points. And turning the page in this front section of the Cincinnati Inquirer, let's talk about aid in dying, Ohio nurses say. This is by Ann Saker. For the first time, an Ohio organization of medical professionals has decided to support letting terminal patients in the state get medical help in dying. The Ohio Nurses Association, that's the largest nurses union in the state, with 11,000 members, convened in Cincinnati last month and approved sweeping language calling for legislation and more education for nurses to help patients at life's end. ONA President Deborah Arms said the proposal recommends educating the public about medical aid in dying, supporting legislation to protect the rights of dying patients, to control the circumstances and conditions of their death, and providing resources and education to nurses about nurses' role in caring for patients regarding MAID or any other form of treatment limitations. These recommendations are an extension of what nurses are ethically obligated to do, which is to protect and advocate for the rights, needs, and wants of their patients. Oregon became the first state to enact a medically assisted suicide law in 1997. The movement has spread to California, Colorado, the District of Columbia, Hawaii, Montana, Maine, New Jersey, Vermont, and Washington State. The laws require at least two doctors certify that a patient has 6 months or less to live. The patient must obtain the lethal drugs in person and take them without help. The ONA statement mirrors the agenda of a Cleveland nonprofit advocacy group, Ohio End of Life Options, which has pushed for the legislation since 2014. No other statewide medical professional groups have said anything out loud about medical aid in dying. Ohio End of Life Options has recruited a volunteer cadre to staff an education table to Ohio Medical Group meetings to talk to doctors and nurses about the desire for such relief. Vicki Miller of Milford and her father, Don Richardson of Mainville, told their story in September about joining the cause after the March death of Betty Richardson, Vicki's mother and Don's wife of half a century. In October, they worked at the ONA convention. Nurses and doctors are ethically prohibited from providing drugs with the purpose of ending life. But in June, the American Nurses Association issued guidance for 1 million nurses in the 10 jurisdictions with aid in dying options. Nurses have an ethical duty to be knowledgeable about this evolving issue and have a right to conscientiously objecting to being involved in the aid in dying process, the ANA said. Medical aid in dying is not equivocal to euthanasia, it's not equivalent, rather, to euthanasia, which occurs when someone other than the patient administers medication with the intention of hastening death. The National Association said, euthanasia is illegal in the U.S. and inconsistent with the core commitments of the nursing profession. Last year, the only aid in dying bill ever proposed in Ohio never got out of committee and has not been offered again. The public may be leading on this issue. Last year, a survey that Ohio End of Life Options commissioned found 87% of Ohioans believe terminally ill patients should be allowed to die in as humane and dignified a manner as they see fit. The support cut across partisan lines with large majorities. Lisa Vigil Schattinger, executive director of Ohio End of Life Options, also is a nurse. She said she's proud of the ONA's advocacy for this option that will be so important for the terminally ill in Ohio. since one in five Americans has access to medical aid in dying. Ohio nurses are getting questions about it, and they need to be able to fully discuss and advocate for all health care at the end of life. It's time now for commentary. This is Politics Extra by Jason Williams. How Andy Beshear Can Repay Northern Kentucky. Well, here are Jason's final thoughts and takeaways from the 2019 election across Greater Cincinnati. Number one, Beshear, a bridge builder. I'm talking about Andy Beshear, Kentucky's governor-elect, making it a top priority to build a new Brent Spence Bridge. Andy owes Northern Kentucky for getting him elected, and a new bridge would be a way to pay back one of the often forgotten regions of the Commonwealth. We're all tired of hearing about it. We're all tired of politician after politician, including Beshear's father, former Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear, saying it's a priority and then not getting it done. It's going on 20 years since then U.S. Senator George Voinovich started beating the drum on the need for a new Brent Spence Bridge. The legendary Ohio politician is dead. There's no plan to pay for a new bridge. Outgoing Governor Matt Bevin had intentions of focusing on the bridge after he got elected in 2015, but he wasted too much time trying to appease the Northern Kentucky Tea Party activists by commissioning a study on the cockamamie idea of building a bypass around Northern Kentucky, despite the region already having one in I-275. It baffles me that Kentucky wasted time and $2 million in taxpayer money to study the $5 billion Eastern Bypass idea. That's double what the Brent Spence Bridge Corridor project is supposed to cost. Bevin came into office thinking he could build the new bridge without tolls, and he eventually came to the conclusion it's not possible. Some political insiders are wondering if his comments about tolling during the final gubernatorial debate at Northern Kentucky University ended up leading to the region turning on him. There's no way around having some type of tolling on a bridge of this size, Bevin said during the debate. Beshear has to stand up to the few anti-toll loudmouths in Covington and find a way. It won't be easy with a Republican-controlled legislature that traditionally has viewed Northern Kentucky as part of Ohio. Maybe the size of the project can be reduced even more. Maybe Ohio can chip in, even with more money. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine is standing by and waiting to work with Kentucky on the bridge. All I know is the bridge turns 56 years old this month, carries double the traffic it was intended to. It isn't safe, and it needs replacing. Ohio is ready to go. Cincinnati and Northern Kentucky business leaders are ready to go. The issue lies in the lap of the Kentucky governor. No more studies, no more distractions, no more excuses. Get it done. And three names to remember. In Hamilton County, both Democrats and Republicans get some folks elected who they view as future candidates for higher profile offices. Here are three of these newly elected politicians whom you should expect to hear more about. Janiah Trotter Branton. The Bond Hill Democrat won the municipal court seat once held by Fannin Rucker, who left the bench last month to run for prosecutor in 2020. Trotter Branton has been an attorney for prominent local civil rights firm Gerhardstein & Branch. She's been influential in recent years in helping Democrats get elected to the bench. And Trotter Branton could eventually make another run at the prosecutor's office. Christy Dukes Davis. Her victory for Springfield Township trustee was big for the Hamilton County Republican Party, of which she's vice chairwoman. Davis was a key member of the party's new recruiting class, and her win over Democratic Jamie Ray perhaps shows the GOP is on the right track with trying to recruit more women and minority candidates. Davis won the seat long held by Democrat Gwen McFarlane, who couldn't run for the re-election after accepting a seat on the Board of Elections. Republicans now control all the seats on the Board of Trustees in Springfield Township. That's an inner ring suburb that has been trending blue for years. Moreover, Davis has given her party some hope that they can be competitive in upcoming elections. And Matt Waller, the fact that the Republican won a four-way battle for Coleraine Township trustee after just moving to that area earlier this year is a testament to his work ethic. Few people in local politics work harder than Wallert, who was a key organizer in last year's petition drive to kill the commissioner's efforts to raise the sales tax. You may remember Wallert set out to lose 150 pounds during his campaign. The elder high school teacher didn't quite make it, but he did drop 92 pounds and says he's not giving up on living a healthier lifestyle. He's technically not new to public office. Wallert held a brief stint on the North College Hill City Council after being appointed to the seat a few years ago. Democratic sample ballot is powerful. The city of Cincinnati might be bluer than it's ever been, evidenced by how the Democratic Party's endorsed candidates fared in the school board race. Ozzie Davis received nearly 13,000 votes as a write-in candidate, a staggeringly high number for someone whose name wasn't on the ballot. That can really only be explained by the fact that he was endorsed and therefore on the sample ballot. He didn't win a seat in the field race, but he didn't finish last like most write-in candidates usually do. Davis was fourth in the six-person race, and there's no doubt Davis would have finished ahead of third-place Ben Lindy, the only non-endorsed Democrat who won a school board seat. It still took Lindy raising $250,000 to overcome not getting the endorsement. Incumbents and endorsed Democrats Eve Bolton and Carolyn Jones were the top two finishers. Their vote totals were close, further showing that being on the Democratic sample ballot is very important. In the head-to-head race for the unexpired school board seat, endorsed Democrat Pam Bowers cruised to victory with 54% of the vote. Tuesday's results should send a clear message to any non-Democrat thinking about running for mayor in 2021. It'll be nearly impossible to defeat an endorsed Democrat in a head-to-head race. You can email Cincinnati.com political columnist Jason Williams at jwilliams@inquirer.com. Next, Playhouse seeks help to reach a fundraising goal of $49.5 million. This is by David Lyman. It's time for round two of the Playhouse in the Parks capital campaign to fund its new theater complex in Eden Park. The theater company announced the new complex in February 2017. It's been quietly raising money from foundations, corporate sponsors, and board members ever since. They're now 70% of the way to their goal of $49.5 million. The building will cost $46.3 million, with the remaining $3.2 million going to a variety of transitional expenses related to the project. This is not one of those Cincinnati projects that five or six prominent families are going to finance and the rest of us get to enjoy, artistic director Blake Robison said. For the record, many of those generous donors that Robison refers to have already stepped up, most notably Mo and Jack Rouse, the lead sponsors of the new main stage theater, which will be called Mo and Jack's Place, the Rouse Theater. The people who Robison and the Playhouse are looking to now are the theater's 12,000 subscribers and other theater-interested people in the community who are willing and able to invest in the city's largest resident theater. This is a once-in-a-generation project, Robison said, and the Playhouse belongs to everybody. The current main stage, the Marks Theater, opened in 1968 and has only had modest upgrades in the years since. Besides having roomier seats and a more spacious lobby, the new theater will be far more technologically advanced than the one it's replacing. Another thing people may find exciting is that with the new configuration, we'll be able to serve as a partner for Broadway producers and get in on that circuit of pre-Broadway tryouts, Robison said. Nearly every year, one or two productions arrive on Broadway after spending a month or more in regional theaters. Several Playhouse peers have benefited from the arrangement, including the Old Globe in San Diego, the Alliance Theater in Atlanta, and Repertory Theater of St. Louis. With this new facility, we could very well be a part of that. Armed with a new 99-year lease and approval from both the Cincinnati Park Board and the Cincinnati Planning Commission, the Playhouse released new final renderings of the project, as well as a video walkthrough of the building. Other details of the new lease are an increase in rent from 90 cents per single ticket to a flat rate of $85,500, which will be reappraised every 10 years. In addition, the Playhouse will now oversee an expanded piece of the park property, growing from the current 1,635 acres to 6,772 acres. Basically, it includes everything inside the Ring Road, that's the Mount Adams Circle, exclusive of the swimming pool, Robinson explained. He's talking about the Cincinnati Recreation Commission pool located at the east end of Playhouse parking lot. Site preparation is set to begin in the spring of 2020, with construction starting in the fall. The entire complex is scheduled to open in fall of 2022. And continuing on in this front section of Sunday's November 10th Cincinnati Inquirer, doctors expand weight loss surgery for kids. This is by Joanne Viaviano. Calling severe obesity in children and adolescents a worsening health crisis, the American Academy of Pediatrics is asking physicians, policymakers, academics, and insurance companies to help reduce barriers to surgical weight loss options for youth. Access to metabolic and bariatric surgeries for those age groups is urgently needed, the Academy says in a report October 27th, to accompany a new policy statement that makes several recommendations toward that goal. Nearly 10% of children ages 12 to 15 and 14% of the 16 to 19 age group are severely obese, representing about 4.5 million young people. That's double the number from 1999, the statement says. Such young people are at risk of developing complications that have significant and cumulative impact, including cardiovascular, liver, and kidney diseases, type 2 diabetes, and certain forms of cancer, said Dr. Mark Michalski, surgical director of the Center for Healthy Weight and Nutrition at Nationwide Children's Hospital and a co-author of the policy statement. Keeping weight off over a long period can lead to overall improvements in health outcomes, something that has been hard to deliver through traditional behavior modification treatment strategies, he said. But bariatric surgery in young people, available over the past 20 years or so, has delivered over many obesity-related diseases, he said. The results are really quite striking, Michalski said. Not only are teenagers having results that are parallel to the results we're seeing in the adult population, but also some results are emerging that show teenagers may do better than people who wait to get bariatric surgery in adult years. We believe that the pediatric population has, if you will, a protective advantage. The typical bariatric surgery patient is in their 40s or 50s, Michalski said, after obesity has been given decades to do damage. While some of that damage is reversible, it's believed there's a higher likelihood for improvement if the obesity is stopped early on. The policy statement indicates that a potential candidate for adolescent bariatric surgery would have either class 2 obesity with a clinically significant disease or class 3 obesity with or without accompanying disease. Class is based on body mass index, or BMI. That's a body fat measurement based on height and weight or on the young person's weight in relation to others of the same age and gender, the policy statement says. A 15-year-old girl who's 5'4", for example, would have class 2 obesity at 194 pounds and class 3 obesity at 227 pounds, based on numbers in the obesity class criteria listed in the statement and a federal BMI and percentile calculator. A 15-year-old boy who's 5'7" would have class 2 obesity at 204 pounds and class 3 obesity at 238 pounds. There's no established lower age limit for bariatric surgery. However, a certain level of maturity and cooperation is required for a child to understand what's at stake and follow through with lifestyle changes that must be made post-surgery, said Dr. Robert Murray, a pediatric gastroenterologist and nutritionist, who is the immediate past president of the Ohio chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. Children generally are evaluated by a team of professionals for up to a year before a decision can be made. Pediatricians are conservative about using measures like bariatric surgery for developing youth. But as more children develop severe morbid obesity, benefits outweigh the risks, says Murray. Age shouldn't be a basis, he added, to deprive them of a powerful treatment tool. About 47% of young people who qualified for surgeries received insurance coverage on a first request, compared with 85% of adults, according to data cited in the policy statement. The most common reason for denial was being younger than 18. This level of obesity that we're talking about brings with it enormous risks for the patient. It really will destroy their life along with their health, said Murray, who once worked alongside Mikulski as director of the nationwide Children's Weight and Nutrition Center. It's time to act, he said. We've reached a point where it's time to make a policy statement and drive policymakers, insurance companies, and medical directors to recognize the fact that this is really the only viable alternative we have for these kids. And continuing on in this front section of the Cincinnati Inquirer, let's do state news in brief, starting with Ohio. State Patrol reminds people seatbelt use is Ohio law. This is from Columbus. Ohio's State Highway Patrol is reminding people to always use seatbelts. The patrol says more than 1,300 people not wearing seatbelts were killed in crashes in Ohio the past 2 years. The state's 2018 observational seatbelt survey found only 85% of motorists are in compliance with Ohio's seatbelt law. The patrol says 121,019 people in Ohio were convicted of driving or riding in a passenger vehicle for not wearing a seatbelt last year. Next, two finalists announced for Ohio Capital City Police Chief. From Columbus, Ohio's Capital City has announced the two finalists for its next police chief and set a date for a community forum to introduce them. Columbus Mayor Andrew Ginther, a Democrat, has said he wants a chief committed to increasing diversity among the ranks and lining up policing with community expectations of the department. The finalists are Thomas Quinlan, currently the interim Columbus police chief, and Perry Tarrant, former assistant police chief in Seattle. Both will appear at a November 21st forum. Next, blinking lights to be added to some Amish buggies for safety, and this is from Ashland, Ohio. A law enforcement official says he's persuaded the bishops of an Ohio Amish sect to install blinking lights on buggies to make them more visible to motorists. The Ashland Times-Gazette reports Ashland County Chief Deputy Sheriff Carl Reichert has been working with local Amish and Mennonite communities for years to make their buggies and wagons easier to spot. Reichert says the community that agreed to install blinkers is more liberal and modern than other sects. And last, Kentucky. University of Kentucky Law School gets a $20 million gift from an alum. This is from Lexington. The University of Kentucky's College of Law has drawn a $20 million donation from one of its alumni. The university announced the gift from J. David Rosenberg and his wife Diane on Friday. The donation is the third largest single gift in university history. Rosenberg specializes in corporate finance, venture capital, banking, and reorganization as a senior partner in the Cincinnati firm of Keating, Muthing, and Kleekamp, where he's practiced since 1974. And turning the page, Ohio plans to boost payments to relatives caring for kids. This is by Andrew Welsh Huggins. Ohio plans to increase payments to approved relatives caring for children who are taken from parents even when the family members aren't licensed caregivers, as more kids are being removed from their homes amid the opioid crisis. The increased payments, ordered by a court and expected to start in the next few months, are meant to eliminate a disparity between licensed foster care providers and relatives such as grandparents or aunts and uncles who've been unexpectedly asked to care for the kids they're related to. Ohio has been under pressure from child advocates to follow a 2017 federal appeals court ruling ordering equality in such payments. The state is currently designing a program to satisfy the decision, said Kimberly Hall, director of the Ohio Department of Job and Family Services. Adults caring for their young relatives are just as valuable in our system of support as foster parents and any others who have critical roles in informing and impacting a child's trajectory, Hall said. The issue has taken on new significance because of the opioid crisis, which has seen a huge increase in the number of children taken from homes because of parents' or guardians' addictions. About 16,000 children are in custody in Ohio today. That's more than a 20% increase from 5 years ago. Currently, relatives who have custody of their children but aren't licensed foster care providers, known as kinship providers, receive around $290 per month for one child, according to advocates for the change, though that can vary by county. By contrast, licensed foster care providers receive from $600 to $6,000 per month for one child. That doesn't include extra payments for a child with special needs, though those payments only kick in once a court has granted custody. In Central Ohio, Crystal Posey has been making do with $293 a month to care for her 2-year-old granddaughter. The 48-year-old office medical manager makes around $36,000 a year, and she's not paid for the days off that she takes when she has to care for the toddler, though she does receive a county stipend to defray child care costs. Still, supplies like car seats and clothes add up, she said. It's a shame that you should pay a stranger to take care of your family more than you would pay a family member to take care of them, said Posey of Reynoldsburg. Becoming a licensed foster care provider, which would make relatives eligible for the higher amounts, isn't an easy choice, said Barbara Turpin of the Ohio Grandparents Kinship Coalition. Passing background checks and ongoing certification requirements is time-consuming, and relatives usually aren't looking to serve children they're not related to, she said. In most cases, when a relative is approached, they take that child because of their connection with child in the family, not realizing all the additional stressors and needs and issues that come up along the way, Turpin said. The federal ruling that ordered equality in payments applied to Kentucky, Tennessee, Michigan, and Ohio, the four states overseen by the 6th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. The payments are expected to cost Ohio millions, but the total amount is unclear, and the state wouldn't provide any figures. In Michigan, the Department of Health and Human Services has spent about $5 million for payments to unlicensed relatives since the Glisson ruling. Kentucky has spent about $27 million. Tennessee has already been making payments before the lawsuit. Paying relatives who choose not to become licensed the extra amount makes sense given the financial challenges they take on, said Richard Dawahar, a Kentucky attorney who brought the original lawsuit. They're stepping up at a moment's notice to take care of that child, he said. Dawahar has filed a second lawsuit against Kentucky over allegations that the state is wrongly interpreting the ruling and not making the required payments to all eligible caregivers. He also plans a lawsuit against Ohio for not beginning the payments yet. The higher payments required by the appeals court ruling are coming too late for Nicole Welch of Green in Northeast Ohio. She and her husband took in a cousin's heroin-addicted baby girl in 2016 and struggled to make ends meet because of the care and medical attention the girl needed. Welch, 39, and her husband chose to adopt the girl, and they've also since become licensed foster care providers. They also have a 13-year-old daughter. The money would have helped. We didn't have anything for a baby, Welch said. And finally, Walgreens cuts ties with a top Medicaid provider. This is by Marty Schlalen. More than half of Ohio's Medicaid recipients will lose access to Walgreens pharmacies on January 1st. That's when Ohio's second-largest pharmacy retailer will exit the state's largest Medicaid pharmacy network, CareSource. Walgreens, Ohio's second-largest pharmacy retailer, will no longer service the state's largest Medicaid provider as of January 1, raising concerns about creating pharmacy deserts in parts of Ohio. The news wasn't announced by the Ohio Department of Medicaid. Comes a week before open enrollment in the insurance program is set to begin, and it also raises worries about access for Medicaid patients and about the health of the marketplace. And it raises questions about how well the administration of Governor Mike DeWine has reformed the way the state Medicaid department reimburses Ohio's pharmacy as it spends $3 billion a year on drugs. CareSource has decided to move forward with a network that does not include Walgreens for Ohio-managed Medicaid patients in 2020, Walgreens said in an email Friday, referring to Ohio's largest Medicaid managed care organization, which serves more than a million recipients. Walgreens remains in the networks of two other care plans, United Healthcare Community Plan and Paramount Advantage. State Senator David Burke, a Republican from Marysville, chairman of the Senate's Health Human Services and Medicaid Committee, said the move sends a very strong signal that serving Medicaid patients is a money-losing proposition for Ohio pharmacies. Burke said he's known for weeks that Walgreens was departing. In an email, state spokesman Kevin Walter said Ohio Medicaid has been made aware of a potential change in the CareSource contract, but the change is still under evaluation. Dayton-based CareSource serves 1.2 million of the 2.2 million Ohioans who are enrolled in Medicaid-managed care plans, and the company also serves Medicaid patients in Indiana, Kentucky, West Virginia, and Georgia. Despite promises of transparency earlier this year, CareSource didn't say whether Walgreens was departing its pharmacy network, and it wouldn't say how many of its Ohio clients use Walgreens as their pharmacy, nor would it say whether Walgreens was leaving its networks in other states. CareSource continually evaluates our provider network to ensure we're offering members excellent access to quality care, Stephen Ringel, president of CareSource Ohio Market, said in an email after news of Walgreens' departure broke. We're in the process of reviewing our future plans with Walgreens, with the Ohio Department of Medicaid, and remain committed to meeting and exceeding all network access standards while also being good stewards of taxpayer dollars. Since last year, the Dispatch has written numerous stories raising questions about whether CareSource's current pharmacy benefits manager, CVS Caremark, was providing low-ball reimbursements to the corporation's retail competitors, including Walgreens. In April, CareSource announced it was dumping CVS Caremark in all the states where it operates and instead was hiring Express Scripts to provide pharmacy benefit manager services, such as billing for drugs, reimbursing pharmacies, establishing lists of covered drugs, and negotiating rebates for drug makers. That's all the time we have today. I'm Barbara Tobias. This is Sunday, November 10th, 2019. It's been the front section of Cincinnati Enquirer. Have a great week.